Good morning. We're opening up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here today. First of all, I want to call to everyone's attention. Senator Thatcher had an excused absence today, so she will not be able to join us. Had family matters that she was attending to. And so what we're going to do today, we're going to pick up where we kind of left off yesterday. We were doing a public hearing on Senate Bill 526. We agreed that we would carry that over for the purpose of taking the last remaining testimony that was signed up yesterday, and that's what we're going to do now. So we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on 526 for the purpose of taking Gail Meyer's testimony. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning. Chair Posonsky, members of the committee, thank you. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Senate Bill 526 is the one that would expand the definition of physical injury and then would also allow for separate criminal crimes to be lodged for bystander trauma in certain domestic violence and assault cases. Let me clarify at the outset that Section 3 of Senate Bill 526, we have no opposition to. This is the one that would elevate strangulation to a felony when, in the instance, the defendant knows that the victim is pregnant. That is consistent with other statutes, and we have no opposition to that.
Gail, before you continue, let me just do one other thing. We had another bill that we had kind of carried over yesterday for a possible work session on Senate Bill 3. At this point, we're not ready to move that, so I apologize for not making that announcement. So if you're here on Senate Bill 3, it is not going to be going into work session today, and so that's the only reason you're here. You don't need to stay since it won't be up. Thank you, Gail.
Thank you. So addressing my comments first to Sections 1 and 2 of Senate Bill 526, it actually is a pretty big deal to expand that definition of physical injury beyond what it currently is, which is impairment of physical condition or substantial pain. We don't really have too much opposition to including it within the definition of physical injury. Fractures, punctures, go away. I just had some screen pop up here and I don't want it to. Fractures, punctures, or burns. We quite frankly think that those do fit within the definition right now of physical injury. The ones that really broadens this is cuts, bruises, and other wounds. Here's what the law is right now. When it comes to impairment of a physical condition, the law is pretty clear that if you have a cut that actually punctures the skin, splits the skin, and exposes the skin to infection, that you're impacting a bodily organ, and so therefore that does constitute an impairment of physical condition. So case law is already clear that a half-inch gash on the scalp that would actually open a wound, that would expose the bloodstream to infection, does constitute physical injury already. The same thing with scrapes. So if you have a really deep scrape that would expose the skin to infection, that already constitutes physical injury. By broadening this to include cuts, what the district attorneys, I think, are hoping to do is reverse a case of State versus Rice. And in that instance, there was some flying shrapnel glass, and the woman had a few cuts, no bleeding, did not puncture the deep part of the tissue. She said it didn't hurt, and within 2 or 3 days, you couldn't even tell that there had been a little nick. And by including the word cut in this definition now of physical trauma, it would indicate through the Court of Appeals and to every other court that little cuts that don't puncture the skin, don't hurt, heal quickly would still constitute this definition. So we think that the case law is already pretty clear, and as guiding practitioners and with charging decisions and whatnot, and the inclusion of the word cuts in there is not necessary. The case law is already pretty clear on this. Bruises is a different issue. The government right now can get a case on circumstantial evidence of substantial pain. There's two ways right now to go for physical injury. One is the impairment of the physical condition, and the other one is substantial pain. Generally, they rely on the victim to say, yes, that hurt. I experienced substantial pain. If you have a child who's not a victim who's nonverbal, either because they're elderly or they have limited intelligence or they're very young, they can still get to a jury on circumstantial evidence that this bruising is so deep and pervasive that there's circumstantial evidence to constitute substantial pain. The one instance where the case that the proponents referred to was State versus Wright. And in that instance, the court simply made a finding there was not sufficient evidence on that record of circumstantial evidence of substantial pain, but then the court did allow it to go to the jury on the other theory, which was impairment of physical condition, and there wasn't enough evidence of that. So in that one instance, they had a finding of fact by the court that they hadn't made enough circumstantial evidence of substantial pain, but that doesn't mean in all instances they're precluded to go to a jury on bruising. There's nothing that would prevent them from going to a jury on bruising. You can base your case on bruising. It would have to possibly be on circumstantial evidence. So our concern with bruising is not all bruises are alike. Some people do bruise easily. There are medical conditions where people do bruise easily. And the other thing we're worried about is the broadening of this as it relates to mandatory reporting of abuse, either elder abuse or child abuse. I have asked, full disclosure, I have asked the state bar to take a look at this. The feedback I got from the state bar is they didn't think that broadening this definition would impact mandatory reporting requirements because the mandatory reporting statute doesn't incorporate by reference this statute, but I continue to believe that it does present a problem because if there is a definition of physical injury which constitutes an assault, which includes bruises, I do believe that a mandatory reporter who would have cause to believe that a child that they've encountered or an elder that they've encountered has experienced abuse, I'd have a hard time believing that wouldn't be incorporated into that. So if there was to be some qualifying definition of the word bruises, I don't know the medical term for it. I don't know if it would be substantial. I don't know if it would be deep tissue. I don't know what the definition would be. But a mere bruise of itself, I think, would be overreaching. The definition of other wounds is also, we think, very broad. We don't know what it means. And we've heard no testimony from the proponents as to what the phrase other wounds would mean. So I would submit that that would be a dangerous thing to include. Now, Section 1 and Section 2, when combined with Section 4, is also a big deal. And let me turn my attention now to Section 4, and then I'll connect the two of them. Section 4 would do something that I don't know is done in any other state, and I don't know, the proponents never allege that it is done in any other state. What Section 4 says, basically, is in the case of a crime in which an element of the offense is that the crime was committed in the immediate presence of or witnessed by a minor child, then the minor child separately becomes it a separate victim. What this law does right now is, with respect to an assault 4, which is a name misdemeanor, if that assault 4 is committed in the presence of a minor child, it is elevated to a felony. The victim of that felony is the victim of the assault. So let's, by common iconic reference, assume it's the woman. What this Section 4 would do is say, if there are two other minor children who witness that assault, there are now three victims, the woman and the two children. If there's four children, then there's five victims, the woman and the four children. When you start analyzing what that does on the guideline grid, it's significant. So a felony assault 4 is a level 6. So if there's no prior criminal history of the defendant, as to the victim who is the adult, that would probably, you would be an I block, which would be a presumptive probationary sentence. If there were two minor children who witnessed the crime, you would, two person misdemeanors constitutes one person felony. You're now over into D block. So you are now into presumptive prison, which is 13 to 14 months. If there were four children present, you would now be in B block, which is presumptive prison of 19 to 24 months. Separate victims can have consecutive sentences. So there's nothing to prevent a court from giving consecutive sentences. So now, and again, I don't know of any other crime where bystander trauma constitutes its own crime. And I don't know of any other state that even entertains this notion. The proponents mentioned none, and I know of none. So when you combine Section 4 with the broadening of the definition of assault in Sections 1 and 2, what it does, if you link them, you could have a cut that doesn't puncture the skin, doesn't hurt, doesn't expose the person to infection, clears up within 2 or 3 days. But if witnessed by minor children, you could end up in prison with consecutive sentences. I mean, the two, when linked together, just get into the stratosphere. So we would exercise, we would encourage the committee to exercise grave caution. The assault statutes were carefully thought out by the Commission of Criminal Law back in 1971. They attempted to carefully calibrate what it was that separated the assault structures from misdemeanors to felonies. Every time that's revisited, there's a tipping and an imbalance in that whole careful calibration, and we think that this these concepts are faulty. So, happy to answer any questions.
All right. Chair's going to take the prerogative and go through some stuff. So I agree with you, Gail, that when I look at this as two cuts, I mean, it could be as simple as a paper cut would actually also, I think, get us to that same scenario. But I do want to ask you about the Supreme Court ruling. I forget the case that was brought up yesterday. You had the trial court, found the person guilty. It was upheld by the Court of Appeals. But when in the Supreme Court, wasn't the rationale was because there was not the articulating of the actual level of injury that would justify the finding of the jury and the upholding of in the Court of Appeals?
As Chair Barker, as I'm looking for it right now. Let me see if I can find it. And I don't know if I saved it in a different spot. I believe that they were referring to State versus Wright. What did I do? Did I call you something? What did I say?
Yeah.
What did I say?
That's all right.
Okay. No, I don't really want to know, do I?
Forgot which Judiciary Committee you're in front of.
Did it? Was it?
Did not look quite like Jeff, but
I'm sorry. There was just too much humor, and I was not being. I wasn't seeing it.
Might have made the clips on this one.
Oh dear. Okay. Oops. Chair Przanski, I believe proponents were referring to the case of State versus Wright. They did mention that by name. And I'm looking for it, and I'm hoping I find it quickly. So here's my memory of what Wright said, because I just reread it last night. There was this little kid, 18 months old, who had had bruising all over the backside of its buttocks and down the leg. And apparently a babysitter had alleged that she had spanked this little kid. The next day, the mother saw the bruises. She brought the child in. As I read the opinion, the trial court said that the state had not presented sufficient evidence, sufficient circumstantial evidence of substantial pain. So she wouldn't let it go to the jury under that theory. What she did say to the state was, but I will let you go to the jury under the alternative theory of impairment of a physical condition. And that didn't fly, because the kid, when examined by the pediatrician, was just running around and having a great time and was walking fine and sitting fine and playing fine. So the Court of Appeals ultimately determined that there wasn't enough evidence of that either. So we don't read Wright to say that in no instances does bruising constitute physical injury. There are cases where they can get to a jury on circumstantial evidence of substantial pain.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify a question?
You may.
Is this the case, the photos that we saw yesterday of the bruising on the buttocks and the legs, were those photos associated with this case?
Yes. That's exactly right.
Thank you.
And Chair Przanski, Senator Gelser, I think people could quarrel whether there wasn't circumstantial evidence of substantial pain. The question really is, was that a perfect outcome? Perhaps not. But the question is, does it merit putting bruising in the statute without further description?
Let me tell you where the chair is at on this, and we've had some discussions. I'm looking at taking the situation that that's been presented where people are individuals are nonverbal, vulnerable people, persons, and looking at that and trying to see if we need to or if we can actually come up with some type of carve-out to deal with that population. Because what I heard yesterday is that they really were trying to focus on those who can't speak for themselves and verbalize how and what it felt like. And that would include not only children or infants that can't verbal, but also could be a disability, disabled. It could be elderly individuals for other reasons. So I'm just giving you a heads up. We're not moving the bill, of course, today.
Okay.
What we are going to do is work on trying to see if we can come up with some type of means of dealing with this special population that apparently, based on even right to me and seeing what I saw, mm-hmm. I can't get to where the Supreme Court got.
And Chair Brzezinski, I think that it was the trial court who made the determination that there wasn't substantial evidence. The court had no ability to review that. That was essentially an acquittal.
Yeah. I'll try to read that. Other questions or comments?
Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 526. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 601.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 601 is an update to the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act. It expands the definition of personal information to include biometric data and a person's health insurance policy number or other information. It requires a person who suffers a data breach of the personal information of another to notify the Attorney General when that breach affects more than 100 consumers. And it also makes violation of the act actionable by the Attorney General under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. You have the proposed -2 amendments before you, and it clarifies what personal information is, and it triggers notification to the Attorney General at 250 consumers rather than 100. We're waiting for the fiscal to come back on the -2s. We may get it by the end of the hearing, and we may not.
All right. We have the Attorney General and also Cheryl. I think you're coming up with her. Is there anyone else that you wanted at the table between the two of you? Aaron was halfway on here, then he got scratched off, so I figured.
I'll stay scratched.
Okay. We're good. Thank you. Good morning. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Oregon and come to you in support of Senate Bill 601 and the -2 amendments. Last Tuesday, Premera Blue Cross announced that they were the target of a successful cyber attack. A preliminary investigation determined that the attackers may have gained unauthorized access to members' information, including name, date of birth, social security number, bank account information, and claims information, including clinical and medical data. After confirming the breach, Premera began the process of sending notice to everyone impacted, 11 million people. The Wall Street Journal estimates that there is a new victim of identity fraud every 2 seconds. The answer to the question, who will be the victim of a data breach, is unfortunately very simple. Everyone, all of us. Data breaches are an increasingly common menace to grocery stores, hospitals, schools, state agencies, online vendors, really any organization with valuable personal information. According to identitytheft.org, in 2014, there were 783 major data breaches resulting in the loss of more than 85 million records. Last year was considered to be a very bad year for data security by any measurement. However, only 3 months into 2015, it is clear that this year will be worse. Already 80 major breaches reported, with an additional 85 million records lost to hackers, theft, and unlawful intrusion, the same number as the entire year last year. It is against this backdrop that I set to review the adequacy of our data breach law, the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act, which was passed in 2007, which seems like eons ago. And in a sense, it is, considering how things have changed since then. My office has spent the last year making a top-to-bottom review of this statutory framework, and I come to you today with a few basic recommendations.
I, Attorney General, I have to just say I feel very old now after that statement. It was my work group back in 2007.
Oh, dear. I've already blown it. Well, Senator Pruzanski, time does fly. The act has two primary functions. First, it says that if personal information has been breached, that the breached company must give timely notice to those affected. This helps consumers to take proactive steps to be on guard against identity theft. And secondly, the law requires those who keep personal information to maintain reasonable security measures to protect it. Like most data breach statutes of its vintage, Oregon's is mostly concerned with financial information, credit cards, social security numbers, and bank accounts. Nearly a decade later, we find that both the targets and consequences of data breach are far more extensive than they used to be. The most significant personal information not protected under Oregon data breach law is medical information. According to the World Privacy Forum, medical identity theft typically leaves a trail of falsified information in medical records that can plague victims' medical and financial lives for years. Consider some of the most common consequences of a medical identity theft. Bills for medical services you didn't receive. Calls from debt collectors about medical debts you don't owe. Notices from your health plan saying that you've reached your benefit limit and can no longer receive further medical services. Or a denial of insurance because your medical records show a condition you don't have. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, provides instruction to traditional medical providers as to what procedures should be followed to protect against data breach. But this protection only goes so far. Not usually covered by HIPAA, life insurance carriers, schools, state agencies, law enforcement, local government, and the increasingly massive array of apps, websites, and other third-party providers who have sprung up to help consumers manage their medical data. So, after extensive review, I make the following recommendations. First, I propose that Oregon insert medical, health insurance, and biometric information under the protections of our data breach laws. We have consulted with the tech industry, insurance carriers, retailers, and other partners in the private sector as to how to best craft these definitions in a way that strikes the appropriate balance between consumer data protection and the avoidance of additional expense and inconvenience for our businesses. I would like to thank our partners in the private sector for assisting us in crafting every one of these definitions and in providing their advice and insight throughout the drafting process. And this has led us to the Dash 2 amendments, which have some modified definitions in as a result of those important meetings. A brief word about biometric data. What is biometric data, and why is it included? Biometric data is any data about your physical attributes, like facial features, retina, or fingerprints. More and more biometric information has the potential to be stolen. Some of us use our fingerprints to unlock our phones. I don't, but many do. This means that your fingerprint information could become the subject of a breach. In December of 2014, a group called the Chaos Computer Club succeeded in recreating the fingerprint of a German defense minister using nothing but readily available technology and high-definition photos. The vulnerability clearly exists. And unlike the password to your bank account, you cannot change your biometric information. You are stuck with it. It follows you everywhere. I worry about what could happen if we fail to take steps to protect this information now. In our overview of the data breach statute, we learned that there have been no enforcement actions in the 8 years since the statute was passed. The current statute gives enforcement power to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS. In 43 of the other 47 states with some form of statutory data breach protection, jurisdiction rests with the Attorney General. This, in turn, allows most national-scale data breaches to be dealt with at the national level, where through the facilitation of, are you ready for this, NAG, the National Association of Attorneys General, there is a special working group addressing a number of the recent data breaches. Without Attorney General enforcement, we are often on the outside looking in. Oregon cannot take the lead on multi-state investigations, and DCBS, frankly, does not have the authority to work within this group. So we can't include DCBS on phone calls, multi-state discussions, and such. So my second request is that enforcement authority be extended to the Attorney General under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to allow Oregon to sit as a full partner in the national discussions and potential enforcement actions around data breach. Finally, I would ask that the state of Oregon require that notice be given to the Attorney General when a large breach occurs, and that would be a breach of more than 250 individuals. And that is also a number that has been negotiated. It was going to be 100, but now it's 250 under the amendments. Many states already require this, and it makes a lot of sense. When a breach happens, it's important that impacted consumers know about it. And that's already the law. But what's missing is any requirement that state government be alerted. Without notice, we will struggle to spot trends in data breach, weaknesses in our own laws, and help consumers distinguish between an authentic breach notice versus a fraudster phishing for personal information. Unfortunately, fake data breach notices have become a popular scam. And I would submit that if we never learn about data breaches in a coordinated way, you as legislators won't know either. This is another weakness of HIPAA, which I mentioned earlier. HIPAA requires notice, but only to the federal government. I'm not comfortable relying exclusively on federal cooperation to protect Oregonians. This is why I would ask that a notice to the Attorney General be required of any data breach impacting more than 250 Oregonians. I don't need much. A simple copy of the notice sent to consumers is good enough. The three changes to the 2007 law that I am requesting are common sense, they're necessary, and they're all consistent with national trends. SB 601 is about keeping our data breach statute modern, useful, and maximally protective of the privacy and data of all Oregonians. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, are we going to have another work group on this?
Well, we've actually had a kind of a work group, it sounds like, that was, let's say, voluntarily instituted, because I did have members of the health area that were concerned with, at least at the beginning of the bill. So we're going to hear from a few when they come up, and kind of see how the meeting of the minds are and stuff like that. We don't have the paperwork. I will probably want to just confirm a couple of things, make sure we're all on the same page. But thank you
very
much.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee.
You bet.
We're available for questions later on if you wish.
Okay.
And I've been tempted to use my fingerprint, and you have disabused me of that.
Well, I don't know how the some of the companies would feel about my statement, but I'm sticking with some numbers, and who knows whether they're safe either.
It either.
Thank you.
All right, so let's see. We have listed here Dave Rosenfield, excuse me, and then with him, Paul Cosgrove and Matt Marquis. Why don't you both come up as well? They're coming up. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify today on 601? All right, Dave, we'll let you go first.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld, the executive director of Osberg, the Consumer Group. Thank you for considering this issue today. Osberg supports Senate Bill 601. We know three things at a broad level. One is that in order to take advantage of all the conveniences of the modern marketplace, consumers oftentimes have to entrust personal information to businesses and vendors. Two, we know that it's very important for those businesses and vendors that take that information to guard it with the highest level of protocol and technology possible. And three, we know that despite all that, that data breaches are going to occur. And that's going to be just a fact of modern life so long as this is the way that our economy is organized. So data breaches are going to occur, and when they do, prevention is the best thing, but when they do occur, once the cat is out of the bag, so to speak, the number one thing that a consumer has to do to protect themselves is just take steps to protect themselves. They got to notify the credit bureaus. They got to notify their bank. They have to do a set of things themselves in order to protect themselves, and they can only do that if they have the they know that their data has been breached. And so that's what this whole thing is about. And the changes that the Attorney General is proposing are sensible, and what they essentially continue to ensure moving forward is that once the breach has occurred, that the next self-interest that is in line is always going to be that of the consumer so that they can take the steps to protect themselves. And so You've already heard the details of the bill, so we'll just leave it at that. We think this is a sensible proposal that brings what was a very good law that we supported back in 2007 into our modern era, and probably changes will need to be made down the road in another couple of years as the economy continues to evolve. But for now, this is a great first step, so thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health. Legacy Health operates 6 hospitals and 20 outpatient clinics in metropolitan Portland, and it's the Oregon's largest non-insurance-affiliated hospital system. I'm not here representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, but I know that my comments are consistent with the concerns of that association and its members. First of all, let me say we take our responsibilities to protect personal information of our patients and employees pretty seriously. We have a very large security and enforcement and organization with respect to the data that we have, and we obviously have a lot of important personal information. But the concerns of Legacy Health and other hospitals regarding 601 relate to the proposed expansion of the definition of personal information to include 2 elements in the -2 amendments. On the page 1, lines 8 through 12, the 2 elements that we're concerned about are element F, a consumer's health insurance policy number and subscriber identification number, and G, any information about a consumer's mental or physical condition, medical history, or medical diagnosis or treatment. And our concern is because those are, in fact, the very kinds of information covered by HIPAA, which the Attorney General testified about. HIPAA dates back to 1996. It's enforced primarily by the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Health and Human Services. And the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Health and Human Services have issued a privacy rule, a security rule, and a breach notification rule, all very detailed requirements that deal with that kind of information, which we all comply with, and including those vendors who assist us in carrying out our services to patients. So, for example, the reach of HIPAA is really quite broad. My law firm, which does work with physicians and other healthcare professionals and therefore has access to healthcare information, is required to comply with HIPAA. I have attached to my written testimony a couple of pages from the Office of Civil Rights website that describe in general terms the kinds of regulations we're required to comply with. Obviously, the regulations themselves are much more voluminous, and I decided not to muddy the public record with all of those regulations. But you can see that there are very specific requirements for when a breach occurs and what we do. Our threshold for breach is 1. Not 250, not 100, it's 1 record lost. And our requirements for notification are, in fact, more detailed, but somewhat inconsistent from those contained in the Oregon Act. Mr. Chair, I recall also the work group, so that means I must be at least as old as you are. I think, frankly, considerably older, but you spent a great deal of time working through this issue. And in the result in 2007, the legislation was, with respect to breach, there were exemptions for certain kinds of entities that complied with federal law to the breach notification provisions. Those were the Graham-Leach-Bliley financial services exemption. But with respect to protection of information, there was an exemption both for HIPAA and for Graham-Leach-Bliley. And the reason for that is there wasn't any element of personal information, the breach of which could trigger the state act that was covered by HIPAA. If we're going to expand the state act to cover HIPAA-required information, we believe at the least there ought to be an exemption for HIPAA compliance. Now, with respect to enforcement, I'd like to point out that since I think the year is 2009, yes, since the year 2009, the state's attorneys general have been given explicit authority to work with the Office of Civil Rights to enforce HIPAA in state law, under state law. So this is not a question of trying to exclude the attorney general from enforcement in these kinds of circumstances. It's, in fact, rather to direct the enforcement to the regulatory scheme, the breach notification provisions, and the other requirements of the federal law with which we already comply. So with that, we would request that if the committee wishes to pursue 601, that there be an exemption in ORS 646A-604 for HIPAA-compliant organizations, just like there is an exemption later in the statute for HIPAA-compliant organizations on the protection of health information provisions. Those were good in 2007. They're still good in 2007, and now I think they should be applied to the breach provisions if we're going to expand the elements of personal information to which breach notifications apply. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's get Matt's testimony, then we'll come back to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing TransUnion, Oregon Collectors Association, and the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association. I'll keep my comments very brief. All of our clients take data, the storing of data, very seriously and put operations in place to make sure that data breaches don't happen. Obviously, sometimes, unfortunately, they do. We are, as amended with, with the Dash 2 amendments, we would be neutral on the bill. I just wanted to thank the Attorney General's office for reaching out to us over the last 6 months or so and meeting with us off and on to work through many of those issues. While we don't have a healthcare client like Paul just referred to, they have been great with our issues and addressing most of those concerns. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I do have a couple things. I guess starting off with what we call the Over My Dead Body work group that we did. That's an inside joke for those who were not part of that work group. So, Matt, I appreciate that you're neutral as with the Dash 2s. Paul, on the sign-up sheet, it says you're neutral if amended. So I'm assuming you're saying you're not okay with the Dash 2s unless they are amended.
Mr. Chair, you are correct. The Dash 2s make good improvements to the base bill. So we're in support of the Dash 2s. What we're critiquing is an additional amendment to add into 646A, 604, an exemption like there is later in the statute for HIPAA compliance.
All right. So we met after I think we had a – if I'm not mistaken, a hearing, pre-hearing on 601 already. But we met in my office a number of individuals, and I was supposed to be receiving information back regarding how other states have dealt with HIPAA and the issues that you are raising. Do you have that information?
Mr. Chair, we have asked that California has been identified as another state that has something similar to what 601 has. One of our colleagues who runs one of our competing health systems who has operations in California has made the request for that information. As of yesterday afternoon, they were following up on that request but did not have it. We are still actively pursuing that information. I think the answer to your question is no, we do not have that information, although we are seeking it. I think our concern, though, is really rather specific. And whether or not this is dealt with in the California statute, I don't know. But in Oregon statute, we can, I think, meet the needs of the Attorney General to expand the kinds of information that are under the Act, but still not require HIPAA-compliant entities to have duplicate breach notification provisions. And that's the amendment that we're seeking, is to eliminate inconsistent and duplicative breach notification provisions.
Right. And then the other thing on the what I thought was somewhat of a kumbaya, but now we know it's not, the moving from 100 notification for a breach that impacted 100 to 250, I'm assuming that was a request from the agent or from the business side that they wanted to raise the threshold from 100 to 250.
Mr. Chairman, we weren't part of those discussions. My understanding secondhand is that is true. It's not a request from the health system side because, as I mentioned, our breach notification threshold is one. So 100, 250, all of those are higher than ours. We will be notifying on a breach of personal medical information at one consumer.
Mr. Chair, I think the 250 arises kind of as a compromise. We, TransUnion, asked for something closer to California, which is 500, and to try to be consistent with California's newest law that they have there. The Attorney General came back at 250. While we would like to see the number higher than 250, that's how it's drafted in the Dash 2.
Let's see. What's the population of California?
Yeah, understood the population. I'm not sure that there's a direct correlation to the population or not. I don't know how many notices the Attorney General would like to get. I think is something else. There are other states I've heard that does have one, and obviously their Attorney General's office is getting flooded. I believe I was told the 250 came from North Dakota, is what I'm saying. I think that was the first time that I had heard comparison to a statute from North Dakota. So,
all right. Well, thank you all very much. Let me ask if there's any other questions. Senator Cruz doesn't look like any. Everyone else has left us, so.
I think they heard about how long you spent in your work group and were afraid that would start.
It was a few months.
It was a long time, I recall. Thank you, Mr.
Gentlemen,
Chair.
Thank you all very much for coming forward. So we had one question that came in, and for Attorney General Rosenblum. Is it the intention of the Attorney General that property and casualty insurance companies and breaches would be covered under the bill?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, they would not be covered.
Not.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Y'all have a good day. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 601. And I will state that we have received the fiscal, but I believe there's a little bit more work that needs to be ironed out. And so the chair will be checking with the Attorney General and other interested parties to see if we can get a better close meeting of the minds. So that's now closed. We're going into where my cheat sheet is. We're going to Senate Bill 740. Shauna?
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee. Member of the committee at this point.
We're a sub right now.
Senate Bill 740 comes to you from Senator Shields on behalf of Disability Rights Oregon. Currently, if a hearing impaired or speaking impaired person is arrested, an interpreter must be made available to them at the earliest time possible following arrest. The court determines who is responsible for the fees for that interpreter at a later date. Senate Bill 740 requires the employer of the arresting officer, so the arresting jurisdiction, to pay for the interpreter regardless of whether the person could show that they could or could not obtain an interpreter.
All right. And then on 740, we have Bob. You're here. Is anyone else, Mr. Junoff, who wants to testify today? Looks like you're on your own, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And member of the committee?
Of the subcommittee.
Of the subcommittee. Thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 740. This was a matter that was brought to my attention by an attorney in Lane County because of an incident in which a hearing impaired individual was denied a sign interpreter when being interrogated by police, and that attorney had brought a claim successfully because of a violation of that person's rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And he brought to my attention the fact that ORS 133.515 had directed law enforcement to seek payment for that interpreter from that individual suspect in violation of the ADA. And so Senate Bill 740 is very specifically designed to make state law consistent with federal law to avoid this type of confusion, misunderstanding about what the standards are for the requirement to provide interpreters by police officers when when asking questions to suspects or other individuals. I've provided, along with our testimony, some information from the U.S. Department of Justice that interprets and explains the requirements of the ADA. And rather than repeat those, I just say that they make clear that police services are covered by Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that police services are required to make reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities, including sign interpreters if necessary, at no charge.
All right. Any questions? Thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate you bringing this forward. Again, I'll ask if anyone else wanted to testify on 740, not seeing anyone running up to the dais. We'll close the public hearing. And now we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 274.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Currently, the Attorney General is authorized to bring suit against a person who is engaging in an unlawful practice, including unlawful debt collection practices. The underlying bill here would allow the Department of Consumer and Business Services to have concurrent jurisdiction with the Attorney General. It would also modify which attorneys were required to be registered as collection agencies, and would provide exemption for registration requirements for out-of-state collection agencies. There are the proposed -1 amendments here today which remove the concurrent jurisdiction piece. I understand there may be other amendments coming. This is not ready to move today.
All right, thank you. So we're going to start off with the proponents that are listed. And that's going to be David Tapman as well as Richard Blackwell.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Tapman. I'm the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Next to me is Richard Blackwell, our senior policy analyst, who's been working on this matter with the Department of Justice and various stakeholders. As the chair well knows, but the rest of the committee may not, we've had an informal work group get together to discuss this bill. Just by way of some background before we discuss this and the -1 amendment that's being put forward, I just want to give some background to the regulation of debt collection in the state of Oregon. In the state of Oregon, the regulation of debt collectors is a bifurcated process. We, the department, regulate debt collectors, and we also oversee the relationship between debt collectors and those creditors or companies that contract with the debt collectors to have their debt collected. And so the relationship that we oversee is between business to business. The relationship between the debtors, those people who owe the debt and are being pursued through the collection process, is overseen under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act by the Department of Justice. And so there's a bifurcation there, and historically that has worked okay. And as we've seen the changes in our economic circumstances within the nation and in Oregon, we've seen a proliferation of debt collectors and people getting licensed to collect debts in Oregon. At this point, we have over 800 debt collectors licensed with us, and the vast majority of them are people out of state. We've also seen a proliferation of attorneys engaged in debt collection practices. So it was our perception that we were seeing an increasing number of complaints about people engaged in debt collection practices, and particularly those who were violating the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. The Department of Justice, as you heard earlier in Senate Bill 601, has a process by which, in many instances, they will look for patterns and practices and engage in oversight of activities that they are charged with oversight of. And in this case, the regulation of debt collection practices, by involving themselves with the National Association of Attorney Generals, the NAG that the Attorney General just referenced, or look for large cases and opportunities to set standards. Many times, though, we will see individual complaints come in. One individual debtor will feel aggrieved by a violation of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. And we feel that as the regulator, we serve a function as the cop on the beat. And we're the person that the complaint could come to, and we could address that with our licensees one-on-one rather than look for a potential lawsuit. As we discussed, there was an informal workforce that the chair called. We've had conversations. The perspective that was put forward was, in essence, the Department of Justice is on top of this problem, and there isn't a real need for this duplication. As a part of that discussion, we talked with the Attorney General's representatives about the possibility that the state, that is DCBS, already has authority to pursue some of this through rulemaking. We've asked for clarification with the Department of Justice. It is not clear that we have that authority, and so that's why this bill is still alive. If we were clear that we had authority to go after rulemaking to allow us to handle consumer complaints, we would feel like we could then complement the Department of Justice. Our goal right now is to do just that, not supplant the Department of Justice, but complement them. And so that was the genesis of Senate Bill 274. As it stands right now, the -1 amendments would make significant changes to that. It essentially would strip out DCBS having any concurrent jurisdiction. It would still leave two parts, though, that the committee should be aware of. One, the Legislative Council took the opportunity to update a lot of language within this. The language is antiquated it is obscuring or obfuscating in that it uses phrases that are not consistently applied, such as plaintiff and defendant, which is fine in a legal setting, but many times debtors and creditors are not have not gotten to that stage, and so it is confusing who's a plaintiff and who's a defendant. We're asking, and they've adopted language to talk about creditors and debtors, and we think that in and of itself is some benefit. The other issue, as I mentioned, is we are seeing a lot of attorneys engage in debt collection. I'm sure the committee, I know the chair, and perhaps the committee has heard, the Department of Justice has taken action against one attorney or two attorneys down in Lane County who were engaged in essentially debt collection. They weren't engaged in the practice of law. They were engaged in debt collection. That is a case that is now wending its way through the Court of Appeals and to determine who's got jurisdiction over this, the state bar or Department of Justice in its enforcement of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. As our part, we want to clarify the definition of who a debt collector is. Right now, the definition excludes all attorneys who are engaged in the practice of law, and the debt collection is associated with that practice of law. Our proposal is to come forward and narrow that definition and make clear that they are doing this on behalf of a client, that this is not a part of a practice where they are, in fact, doing this for themselves, and that is their business model as opposed to the practice of law, and this is incidental to that practice of law. We understand there's some concerns about that from the state bar. We're happy to listen to those concerns and try to work through those problems. But those two points we think should be addressed, and therefore we urge passage of Senate Bill 274 as it comes to its final position, subject to the Dash 1 amendment.
All right. Thank you. And Richard, are you also speaking today?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, just to put myself on the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, Senior Policy Analyst with the Department of Consumer Business Services. I have nothing more to add. I think my boss's testimony captured it nicely. Thank you.
Thank you for assisting him with his testimony.
Sure.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you. Let me ask if there's any questions before I release. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right. The next two individuals I'm going to call up is Amy Zubko and Matt Marquis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association, a association of mostly Oregon-domiciled collection agencies, testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 274. As you heard, there are two major kind of components to Senate Bill 274. First would be the dual regulation of complaints against collection activity. The way the bill is drafted would not just be against collection agencies, but it would be against anybody collecting a debt that falls underneath our Collection Practices Act today. In 2009, I believe it was, is when this legislative body gave jurisdiction to the Attorney General over complaints of that act. Our association at the time was actually opposed to that regulation or that change in regulation. At the time, we offered up a compromise to allow Department of Consumer Business Services to oversee those complaints instead of the Attorney General. Department of Consumer Business Services at that time said they were not interested in that. And so we did end up with the passage of that bill and the Attorney General investigating and handling all of those complaints. I have to say that I think our association at the time for opposing that was probably wrong. It's turned out to be a very good scenario. They meet with our association from time to time to review complaints, to look at how things are handled. And I know the previous witness just talked about the Attorney General only handling large number or instances where I think he said there's been a large number of complaints against one individual or to that extent. I may have misunderstood what he said, but I can tell you that there is at least one case I know of where there were not a lot of complaints filed against an individual here in Oregon, and the Attorney General went after them and fined them, and rightly so. I mean, the person was doing something he should not have done. So we would be opposed to the dual type of regulation. We think the Attorney General is handling things, getting people in compliance. They have gone out and, audit is probably not the right word, but they've gone through and looked through collection agencies to make sure their best practices are what they should be. They've given people kind of a clean bill of health, if you will. And so we think that relationship is working well. The second change deals with licensure of attorneys. I'm not sure that the language in the bill is written the way that it is intended. Our association is neutral on that piece as far as whether or not an attorney's office that is in the business of collecting debt pretty much on behalf of themselves, if you will, or acting as a third-party collector, we're neutral on the fact if they should have a license or not. I do want to point out two other changes that are in the bill. One increases the bond amount for a collection agency from $10,000 to $15,000. I'm not exactly sure what the need here is. I haven't heard of any reason why the $10,000 bond isn't high enough. So I'm a little unclear why that needs to be increased. And then the other one is the increase of penalty for violations, again, from $1,000 to $5,000. And again, I don't think it was addressed in the previous testimony, but I'm not sure why the $1,000 isn't sufficient enough in the types of complaint or types of violations that they're addressing. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and hear from Amy first.
Good morning, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Amy Zebko, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Bar. I'm here today to express the bar's concerns regarding the proposed changes to the definition of attorney found in Section 2 of the bill. As has been mentioned a couple times, the definition has been narrowed in SB 274. And furthermore, the regulation of attorneys has been historically recognized as something done by the Oregon Supreme Court through the Rules of Professional Conduct. We're happy to work with DCBS on looking at further language, but we just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Let me see if there's any questions for anyone before I start.
Okay, I'll start.
Matt, I'm going to start with you as to, I know that there's always been a concern from debt collectors as to having dual jurisdiction. What is your thoughts, if you can give them to me now, as to some type of process that, let's say, it goes to the Attorney General. Attorney General decides to refer that to DCBS. I understand right now we're looking to see what authority DCBS actually has through the rules as to the authority to do rulemaking and stuff like that. So if there was, let's say, one place it starts, but for whatever reason, the Attorney General says we would prefer that this goes through DCBS, would that be appropriate if they basically assigned it to that agency?
Mr. Chair, that's the first time that question's been posed to me. I'd want to think about it, but if we're in a scenario where the Attorney General is giving up any right to then further investigate it after DCBS, I think that would be something we could talk about. I would worry, though, that we'd fall into a scenario where DCBS is doing some kind of investigation, leveling some kind of fines, and then later on the Attorney General is going to issue some sort of fine on their own. That's really the scenario we're trying to avoid.
Okay, I understand that. So I know this is first impression, but I'm just trying to see if there's a way that we might be able to accommodate the concerns that have been raised. And I guess, Amy, I know that you're pinch hitting today, but it does seem to me that if you have an attorney who's in the practice of collecting debt, and it seems to me we have a different means of discipline and sanctions, that they would be maybe less stringent through the bar, or could be, than if they were being subject to the same application, be it through the Attorney General's office or through DCBS. So you may want to bring that to the bar's attention, because I do think that you are talking about a scenario where you could have different applications, and I don't know what the various sanctions the bar would look at, because it seems to me that a lot of it is not, let me just ask. I don't know the bar having any ability to place fines or monetary sanctions against an attorney.
Is that a question or an observation?
That's question. My observation. Okay. I guess it is a question as well, because I know there's written letters that go as to calling someone out. I see that in the bar journal every month, who gets disciplined that way. But I mean, it seems to me that's a different process, and the sanctions seem to vary greatly compared to someone that's in the business, that's not an attorney, could be actually monetarily sanctioned, where I don't think the bar sanctions attorneys on based on monetary type of fines or discipline.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'm not sure of the answer either, but I can certainly find out and get back to you.
That would be great.
All right, Mr. Chair, if I may, just to follow up on your first question, I think you're probably going to hear from the Attorney General's office next, but I think their mission really is to get people back into compliance. If there is somebody that is, you know, breaking or bending a law, if you will, or there's some question of that, you know, their first mission is to get somebody into compliance. So I would want to hear what the Attorney General's position was on referring cases to DCBS, but I do know that that is their first and foremost is to get people into compliance.
Oh, they'll get that question. You just happened to be at the dais before they were. All right. Any other comments? Thank you all very much. And so it does bring up the last of our individuals for today's hearing, Aaron Knott and Cheryl Hemstraw. While they're coming up, let me make certain there's no one else in the room that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 274. Aaron?
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Justice and the Oregon Attorney General. We are neutral on Senate Bill 274 as amended by the Dash Ones. As the chair is aware, the Department of Justice did have some concerns going into the discussion of this bill that were mostly oriented around, I guess, what I'll call the logistics of co-jurisdiction. The Department of Justice received primary enforcement jurisdiction in this area, I believe, back in 2009, and we've been pretty active here from an enforcement perspective, at least as far back as 2011. But one point that I want to emphasize, we have multiple methods of case intake. The predominant one is a hotline. It's just a general consumer protection hotline. We get thousands, if not tens of thousands of complaints, which we then sort of parse out by subject type. And it's, I think, always a surprise that at the end of the day, when you look at the numbers of how many complaints we receive versus how many enforcement actions we actually take, it looks like we're only taking enforcement action on a very, very small fraction. The reason for that, not to put too fine a point on it, is you'd be amazed how much compliance we get just from sending a letter from the Department of Justice that notifies a business or individual that they are out of compliance with the law. Which is to say most of our cases resolve informally and very early in the process without the filing of formal litigation or any sort of action. And so the point I want to emphasize is that these complaints are addressed when they come in. We do open a file. We do have somebody look at them. But if we can resolve it early, we do. Now, as you've heard from previous testimony, the Department of Justice, we're not in the business of representing individuals. So we'll take action when we see a pattern or practice that is enough of enough magnitude that we think Oregonians need to be protected for the sake of everybody in the state. This can be just one action committed by one person, one business, one time, as you heard from Mr. Marquis, or it can be the accumulation of multiple actions. And where that becomes relevant here is a case comes into the Department of Justice. We get one incident, it might not establish a pattern or practice. We start getting more incidents coming in subsequently, it could establish a pattern or practice. So we right away saw some issues about, well, if we get it and we take one form of, say there's an informal resolution, then we kick it over to DCBS, we get more complaints, what do we do? I think where we leave off on Senate Bill 274 as amended by the Dash Ones is that there is work that can be done between DCBS and DOJ to figure out how to do a better job of sharing responsibility with these cases, taking advantage of DCBS's ability to impose administrative sanctions, licensing revocation, and other things that they're very, very good at doing and I think are relevant here. But we hope to take those conversations into the interim. This is going to be a general counsel project in terms of determining the scope of rulemaking. It's not something we can do on a legislative timetable, but we are willing to commit to having those conversations going forward and reporting back to the chair as we move into the interim.
Right. Thank you. Cheryl?
Chair Pozanski, I'm here to answer any questions or help if needed.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I use the same strategy.
Yeah. All right. Any questions for the Attorney General's office? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 274. We're opening up our last public hearing for today, House Bill 3037. Chana?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3037 comes to you from the Rules Committee. By way of a little background, this bill deals with public record requests. There are two categories of records that are exempted from the general requirement that public records be disclosed. One is found in ORS 192501, and it provides a general category of records that are exempt unless the public interest requires disclosure. ORS 192.502 has a list of records that are exempt from disclosure and generally do not have a public interest disclosure requirement. Sometimes there are exceptions to that, such as the address, social security numbers, date of birth, and telephone numbers of public body employees and volunteers. If a person goes to a court and can show by clear and convincing evidence that the public interest requires disclosure. House Bill 3037A removes that disclosure based on clear and convincing evidence and extends the exemption to residential addresses, telephone numbers, personal cell phone numbers, email addresses, driver's license numbers, and other contact information, and it extends the exemption to personal identifiers of home care workers, family child care providers, and operators of child care facilities and adult foster homes.
All right, thank you. Representative Hoyle's here. I'm assuming she's here for the bill because it doesn't check, so I went ahead and took the liberty of checking the four box. If you'd like to come forward. And did you want anyone else with you? I've got three more that are going to testify after you.
Up to you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoyle, glad you're here.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Hoyle from House District 14. I represent West Eugene and Junction City in the greatest county in the state, and that would be Lane County. I'm here to introduce House Bill 3037 to you. It passed off through the House Rules Committee unanimously and off the House floor 56-2. The goal of this bill is to protect private information of people who work with or for public agencies, including people who work in potentially dangerous situations whose personal safety is at risk. The bill would protect their personal cell phone numbers, address, email address from the public record, but most importantly, all documents, emails, correspondence, meeting minutes, and other public records are not affected by this bill. In my committee, we heard testimony from people who worked in child welfare, who worked in other public agencies where their lives and their families were in danger. Understand that in a bill that we passed previously, people's retirement, the amount they make for retirement, the amount of money they make in their salary is all public record. So people can find that out. What we're doing is protecting those people from having their addresses, their phone numbers, their emails, and in the case of some home health workers, their social security numbers from being open to a public records request. So if you're being stalked, I don't think that we as a state should enable people to find that personal information. Again, I believe that any business done for the public should be open to public record. This is just being about protecting people's private information, and this is a good bill, and I wanted to come over to share with you that the testimony we heard was quite impactful, and I think you'll be hearing from some of those people, and I urge you to move this bill through committee. It's a good bill and should pass.
Thank you. Questions for the representative?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just want to commend the chair of the House Rules Committee for preserving the important things in these situations and really limiting the protection to the personal information that really could endanger somebody. So, nice work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. So we have three individuals that have signed up. Is it Tyler Pugh, Rhonda Morgan, and Doug, I believe, Dryden? While those three are coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 3037? Good morning, all. I'm not sure who would like to start, but please give us your name before you start your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, and members of the Senate Committee on Judiciary. My name is Doug Dryden. I'm Chief Steward for SEIU Local 415, which is affiliated with the Oregon Youth Authority. I live near Philomath, and I currently work at the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility in Albany. I appreciate the virtue of brevity and others. I'll extend that same courtesy to the committee. I am here as a representative of the Union Executive Committee to express our support for House Bill 3037. And I have to believe this bill rectifies a problem that never really existed in the first place. While I agree with the need for transparency in our government, an increasingly notable issue in the news both statewide and nationally, we must agree there is a rational limit. Just as freedom of speech must be tempered by limits on slander, advocacy of violent insurrection, or yelling fire in a crowded theater, we must agree there must be a rational limit. Just as freedom of there are those who would take litigious advantage of what some would consider loopholes in the original bill, and we appeal to you to forestall those attempts. As background, allow me to present the case of the Oregon Youth Authority. The general public tends to be wholly unaware that the age of the supposed youth in our charge extends to the age of 25 and includes those under Measure 11 and all crimes that would be found on the rolls of those inmates at the Department of Corrections. Indeed, half our population is classified as DOC, and half are over the age of 18. At my advanced age, I have in previous careers, and just as in this one, been subject to threats in a variety of languages against my life and family. And it's occasionally continued during my current involvement with our incarcerated population. While none, fortunately, have come to fruition, the result has been due in good part to a healthy regard for security. And the coverage that this bill provides enhances that security. I found that when someone threatens to track you down and kill you, you need to take that seriously. This protection already has been recognized in law enforcement and correctional agencies. For example, the address publicly available through one's driver's license can be modified from the home address to reflect the work address. In some agencies, this is a requirement. Failure to add the security provisions of this bill would fly in the face of those policies. In summation, I ask for your support both personally and as a representative of our union. Thank you for your kind attention and consideration.
Thank you. You'd like to go next?
I will. Chairman Przanski and committee members, my name is Twyla Pugh. I am a child protective services worker from Lane County. I'm currently specifically in the Florence area. I had an incident in late 2011 where I removed a small child from a mother for child concerns, safety concerns, and during that time this parent became very hostile, and I'm not unfamiliar with threats said to me and hostility towards me. However, approximately 2 weeks after we had initially gone to court, this parent showed up at my house and sat in my driveway blaring her music, honking her horn, trying to get my attention. Luckily at that time, me and my family were gone on vacation. However, my mother-in-law was at home, and this individual contacted the governor's advocacy office as well as her caseworker, who I had transferred the case to, and actually identified my mother-in-law's pickup in our driveway. This individual contacted me, made threats to kill my child, kidnap her. She had pictures of her. She wanted me to know what it felt like to have a child out of my care and removed from me, and she was going to do everything in her power to make that happen. She talked about my parents, and I was able to go and get a stalking order. When I asked for additional help from an attorney, specifically for the Department of Justice to accompany me, I was denied by one of my program managers, who actually responded to my question with, what would public perception be if we use public funds for private causes? I didn't realize that in the course of my job and meeting people, it was going to be such a private thing, because I would have never met this person had I not been doing my job. This individual violated the stalking order in 2012 by contacting my supervisor and showing up at my work and saying, either you take care of her or I will. Throughout the course of the child being in care, where this mother would visit her child, I was made to leave the premises so she could come in and have her visits instead of moving her visits to an office where I wasn't housed at. I live approximately 30 miles, from the Eugene area, and this individual obviously had a direct course in coming to my home. In 2013, I received a phone call from a person identifying herself as a roommate of this individual. She described my daughter's appearance. She described my house, gave me my address, spoke about detailed plans that her ex-roommate had for setting my house on fire and killing us as we vacated our home. She also had other details about where my daughter went to school. Since that incident, I continue to look out my window. My community that I live in is very small, and I still, my daughter is now 12 years old, and I still have concerns about her even being out in the front yard unattended because of what could happen in the small community. And I am in the process of trying to sell my home and relocate, and hopefully this bill will pass so I will be able to make my new residents unknown to public perception. I'm sorry, public knowledge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rhonda?
Hi, I'm never done this before, can you
You're
tell?
You're doing great.
I'm Rhonda Morgan, and I work for the Department of Human Services in the Self-Sufficiency Program in Gold Beach. And my story is a little bit different. When my children and I got to Oregon in 2003, we were running from a pretty dangerous, pretty violent situation. So we lived off the grid for a while. We stayed very far under the radar because I was terrified that we were going to be found, not only by my abuser, but by the people he owed money to who had already threatened us. It was pretty scary, you know, whole new way of life, always looking over my shoulder. When I came to work for the Department of Human Services in January of 2004, my manager knew that we were in hiding, basically, and asked if I wanted my name kept out of the employee registry. I said, yeah, please. I thought that was the only way that people could find me if they were looking for me as an employee of the state of Oregon. I had no idea that my personal information that I'd been trying so hard to keep hidden would be available to just anybody who asked for it. If I had known that, I don't know that I would have had the courage to come to work for the state. I've been with the state for about 11 years now, and in that time, I've helped families get their feet back under them. I've helped domestic violence survivors develop safety plans for themselves and their families. Currently, I work as a case manager, and I determine eligibility for the temporary assistance to needy families and food stamp programs. I've touched a lot of lives in the 11 years that I've been with the state, and to think that I would have been afraid to do this because somebody could have found me here just terrifies me. I know that my position and my salary and my retirement are all public information, as they should be. I'm a public employee. Taxpayers pay my salary. But I don't believe that the public has a right to know where me and my children live. I don't believe that the public has a right to know my driver's license number, my cell phone number. That's a bit much to ask for public employees. So I'm asking you to support this, not only to protect my privacy, but the privacy of all the workers that serve Oregon every day. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, yes, I was just curious whether people obtained your, that scary woman obtained your information from a public records request. Do you know how she got the information on where you lived?
Some of the information she reported she bought offline. And I don't know how much of that is through public records or you know, or how it was obtained.
Okay, because I, you know, this is that was a very frightening story, and I think we have to keep in mind that we can do what we can, but there's still so much information out there about people.
One of the things with child welfare workers, child protective services workers in particular, is we go out into homes and we have no, we're not even allowed to carry pepper spray or any forms to protect us. You know, we're told to go out with law enforcement, but in rural areas of the state, law enforcement is very slim, and it could take hours, sometimes even a couple days, depending on the shifts, for me to get back up to go out. And my concern is if I wait and don't go out for a couple days, that I could end up with a fatality. And I don't know that I'd be able to live with myself. But I put myself out there because I know that that's my job and I love what I do. But my daughter shouldn't have to pay for what I do as a living. And every bit that we can help protect our personal information would make me feel better. And I went and spent my own money to have representation in order to do everything I could to protect my family.
Thank you.
All right. All right. Let me just say a couple of things. There are multiple things, and maybe after the hearing, I'll talk to you as to some stuff you might want to consider as to how you can have maybe a better approach of keeping some of this information. But Senator Burdick does bring a point that there's so much data out there on people, and there's so many different ways, but there is a way as a state worker that you can, in fact, have a lot of, let's say, access to a lot of that information that would be through the state, basically protect it. And it's through a court order, and we can talk about, if you have not had that opportunity to look at that, to try to hold some stuff off. And I think some other comments I'd like to make to you, I would like to do offline so it's not public. So with that, is there any other questions or comments? With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3037. We're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3037. Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3037A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3037A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions? Discussion? Any objections? So order, please show that Senator Thatcher is excused from the vote. Chair will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3037A. And colleagues, I believe that takes care of our work for today, and we will not be meeting tomorrow, but we will be meeting on Monday, and I hate to inform Senator Burdick, that is 8 o'clock on a Monday morning.
You know, you could just for Senator Burdick's, he could say 7:30, you know that, so, okay.
Oh, I could, but I know what that would mean. I would be in hiding.
We're talking mutiny, Mr. Chair.
With that, we're adjourned.
Chair.
With that, we're adjourned.